Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today. Hello, listener. Welcome back to China Manufacturing Decoded. This is episode 33. Adrian from Sofeast here. I'll be joined by our CEO, Renaud. And today we're rounding out our mini-series on vetting new Chinese suppliers. So this is part number 11 of that series. And to conclude, we'll be exploring things like backup suppliers, supplier development, how to handle unexpected price rises, and some other useful points like this. So you're going to get a bunch of really useful tips here from Renaud that you can really benefit from once you've already found your new supplier and started working with them. If you are new to the series, thanks for joining us. And if you are a long-time listener, great to have you back. Please like and share and give us a rating to spread the word to new listeners too. Right, let's get into the episode. Hello, Renaud. Thanks for joining me as ever.
Hey, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you over there in Hong Kong?
Yeah, good. Busy, good.
Excellent news. Also nice and busy over here in Europe. The UK finally has the vaccine coming in. That's some good news this week, I guess.
Well, you're not first in line, are you?
No, I'm not that old yet. I'm getting older, but 90, I'm not that old.
90-something people first.
That's right.
Let's see what happens. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we'll know more in a bit, but hopefully it's some light at the end of the tunnel. And then, that's of course going to affect everybody that's trying to get back to China and do all the rest of it that we've been precluded from doing in 2020. So I'm hopeful anyway.
If the vaccine actually works in the vast majority of cases, then yeah. Otherwise, I'm going to say, oh yeah, that British vaccine, 70% success rate or something.
Yeah, we'll see on that. The British one's not being used. It's the American one at the moment. The British one hasn't been certified yet. So we will see on it. But watching that with interest. Now, we're catching up today to just round off the mini-series of the China supplier vetting podcast episodes that we've been recording, and we're up to part 11 here, and we've gone through an entire vetting process. And I would urge anybody that is looking for a new Chinese supplier to help manufacture their products and maybe, you know, help them develop the products as well and all the rest of it, to go back and have a listen to this series, because it's really going to, I mean, based on your many years of experience of doing this, you know, this is really going to help people get to grips with vetting suppliers and start things off in the right way if they're not used to it.
Yes. So this is an episode for all the people who don't have a lot of experience working with China. I think people who've been working for some time already know all this, but
sure,
there are some tips really for you're going to start to work with a new supplier. You know, what about the onboarding? What about, you know, when do you need to nail some of the important terms? Because maybe later it's too late. They get less flexible over time. And there's a few key considerations here.
Yes. So this is, now you've vetted your new Chinese supplier and you're working with them, what else are we going to be really mindful of as we move forward and we're in that sort of working relationship? So there's definitely a few sort of key points that I wanted to talk about. So if we start on number one, you have talked about in the past keeping a backup supplier in case certain things go wrong. So let's talk a little bit more about that. How do we nurture and keep this backup supplier?
Now, this depends, you know, on different products. If you buy, I don't know, some home textile or curtains or some, or even, you know, jeans, you know, some, or shirts, you don't really need to do anything with the supplier. You know, you vet them, you fill them out, and then they're not very far away from starting. Now, it's usually not going to make sense to do a lot of development work with them, because even if you you have them work on size set samples and things like that, on a certain style. Maybe next year the style would change. So this is not what I'm about to say is not really applicable to these kinds of products. However, if a supplier to start making production for you needs to tool up or needs to do maybe a lot of different things to prepare themselves to prepare their processes for your production, well, you need to plan ahead because sometimes it takes 3 months, it takes 6 months for the supplier to really get what you want, maybe to source again some of the components, maybe to do a lot of prototypes for you to approve. Maybe they don't get it, fast that this is what you want. Maybe they're not going to be able to make it exactly the same as that other supplier that you have, because maybe the process is quite unique. There are some products like that where people are kind of pushing the envelope and trying different things, and then different factories cannot make it the same way just because of their limitations. Well, you need to plan for all this. If it takes 6 months to onboard a new supplier from, hey, let's go ahead, let's go to production, here's exactly what we need, here's a prototype of what we need and everything, to, okay, now you're starting to produce, so this time is really critical. If it takes you 6 months to get from point A to point B, as I mentioned, well, what happens if you only nurture one supplier, you only onboard one supplier, and then if something goes wrong, you need to go out on the market, find another one, and then spend these 6 months ramping things up with them. That might be actually something you cannot tolerate. This might really prevent you from reaching your business objectives. So in that case, what makes sense is to have actually two suppliers, maybe a main one and a secondary one. And in some cases, it makes sense to give all the orders to one. But then the second one, if you don't give them anything for 1 year or 2 years, they're gonna say, hey, we did all this work for nothing. And they're gonna forget. The key people are going to leave. I mean, even if you invest in a little bit of tooling for them, after 2 years, a lot of suppliers, they forget what your tooling is. What is it? Well, we will forget. That person who was working on it left the company already. Yeah, we don't know. That's the reality sometimes. So you can't just keep them cold. You have to give them a little bit of work from time to time. Basically, that's the idea. And then sort of put them in competition. Maybe the main one, you think, oh, these guys, on the quality side, they seem okay. They have the experience. Da, 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 da. They are faster in developing. Great. And their price is okay. And then you have a backup. Maybe that's more structured, a little bit heavier, a little bit slower. But they're interested to do all the work to get there. Give them something. Even if you say, hey, I'm going to give you, what's your minimum order quantity? 5,000 pieces. Well, give me a few months. Yeah, within 3 months, you get something, right? So you don't give everything to the main supplier. Then over time, the main supplier, maybe they show their limits. They're not very good, maybe. Maybe they pull some kind of shenanigans on you. They raise the price just when they think that they really have you in their hands, right? Oh yeah, it's fine. It's really hard to develop this product. They will really want to keep working with us, whatever we do. Or if they have some repeated quality issues or whatever, then you can switch things over to the secondary one, and hopefully you'll have learned something from your interactions with the first one. You will know some of the failure modes that you need to watch out for, and to tell them to keep in mind. So in that case, it can really be a savior, right? And I see a lot of people going forward with only one supplier for critical products that they really have to always have in stock. And demand fluctuates. Maybe sometimes they you only have stock for 1 or 2 months, it's they receive the shipments kind of just in time sometimes. So if anything happens, well, they're out of stock, and that sometimes can lead to very big problems, very dissatisfied customers. So that's the idea of the backup supplier. Now, if it's a product, there's many cases here. If it's an ODM product, let's say you're walking on Canton Fair, then you say, oh, this is nice, some kind of, I don't know, silicone kitchen tool, kitchen gadget. And you say, oh, this is nice. Yeah, okay, you have the mold and everything. Okay, great. Can you make it in whatever, in green with my logo? And okay, yeah, sure, fine. Well, if things go wrong with this one, you're not going to be able to walk and find the exact same one from the exact same mold. I mean, if you find that, chances are the other one is reselling, you know, one of them, let's say, is reselling, or at least one of them, maybe the, both of them are just doing trading, right? But in the end, it's the same source often, right? If you see it's exactly the same shape, probably comes from exactly the same mold in the same plant. So having a backup supplier is not so easy. Maybe you actually pay for tooling to reproduce that first sample. Now, it might not be a very nice thing to do because you're actually distributing a product that may belong to that manufacturer, or that may belong to a customer of the manufacturer. So you're copying it, and then you could get in trouble because these intellectual property rights don't belong to you, right?
Yes.
But anyway, I see a lot of people doing that. So there's many different cases. Yeah, I can't really generalize that a backup supplier is always important. And obviously, if you can barely go with the MOQs from a supplier, and all the suppliers have the same MOQs, well, you know, and you're still very small for them, but just big enough to get a little bit of attention, then you're just going to dilute that, right? So
yeah,
if you're very small, maybe it's not the wise thing to do.
Right. Okay. Yep. Good feedback there about backup suppliers. That makes a lot of sense from a sort of managing risk point of view. I completely get it. To move on a little bit, so we've spoken about why having a backup supplier can make sense. So if we are having bad experiences from a key supplier and we do have a backup, or we are going to develop a backup very, very quickly, at what point would you say that it's prudent to actually make that switch to the backup? What sort of happens that's so bad that it's time to say goodbye?
Yes, that's a question that often comes back. And it's important to go back to the source of the problem, right? So if a very typical scenario is the buyer comes and says, hey, yes, I need you to make this product. Just make it like that. It's fine. And they go like, you know, you already sell to some customers in Italy, in Germany. Yeah, you know, I'm in France. So, you know, kind of same requirements. Just do what you do for your other customers over there. And this is... People who do that are really beginning at, you know, at this game of sourcing from China, because this is something a professional buyer would never ever say. Because then it means, well, I trust you and you know the standard better than me. And then if I'm not happy with something, you know, you can always get back to me and say, well, but our customers in Italy, they gladly accept it, you know. And what can you say? Because you don't know anything about that case, right? So sometimes it's actually the customer's fault to really be lazy, not do their homework, not document a standard, and then they go to a supplier that is a misfit. So we talked a bit about this earlier in this series on vetting a Chinese supplier. Where are they in terms of quality, price, you know, high volume, low mix? You know, are they okay with high mix, low volume, and so on? And the fit is really important. You know, are you too small for them, too big for them? So if you don't do this job the right way, you might go to the wrong supplier, and then a lot of problems might come up. Where was I going with that? So sometimes it's more of the customer's problem. Maybe they pick the wrong manufacturer, really a very bad fit for them. Or they really made no effort to explain their standard. They made no effort to accompany the factory. I mean, there's got to be some onboarding of the factory, and you really have to explain things to them, and you have to give them a lot of feedback. It's usually better to give a lot of feedback, to be very present. That's sort of prevention, to give them a lot of feedback so they really, really get it, you know, to force a lot of communication. But if you just wait until they ship and you receive the product and you look at it, well, anything could happen, really, right? So it's often the fault of the buyer.
Okay.
And sometimes, of course, it's the fault of the manufacturer. They had a clear standard and they did not comply with it. Well, that's really bad, right? So in the second case, I would say you have one incident. In most cases, you better switch right away. Because they're going to say, oh, we're sorry, you know. So the typical, I don't know how to say, vicious circle. Yeah, I think that's the word. Is the buyer comes, doesn't really give a good standard, doesn't really pick the right supplier, whatever. Doesn't give a lot of feedback, trusts the supplier. Oh, yeah, okay, they're professional. Oh, they are a manufacturer. I mean, they know that much better than I do. They make this product all day long for a lot of other customers in my country. What can I tell them, right? So you trust the supplier way too much. Then production happens. They don't even do inspections. You know, they do the final payment. You know, the products are shipped out. They find a lot of issues. At that point, the supplier says, oh, we're so sorry. you know, oh yeah, it's a misunderstanding. It's this guy, you know, in production or in purchasing that made that mistake. Oh yeah, sorry. You know, now we know much better now. Yeah. We're gonna prevent that in the next batch. You know, and of course the customer is like really upset. Well, you know, how much money I lost on this, and my customers are disappointed. And then what happens? The supplier usually says, well, okay, well, you know, we're going to give you a 15%, 20% discount on the next order, right? And then, okay, well, in the end, the customer gives a second order, you know, sends a deposit again, and maybe they get a little bit wiser, maybe they do inspections, but think about it on the supplier's point of view. Maybe the customer was kind of nasty to them, and called them names and everything. And Chinese people really don't like that. And they will remember that. Plus, the supplier is not going to make money on this one because they give a discount and, you know, a rebate. And what's going to happen? Well, in most cases that we've seen, there are still a lot of issues in the second batch. Because somebody there, maybe I don't know, the wife of the boss, or, you know, somebody is going to make a decision. Say, well, we're not even making money on this. You know, we got to make a deal when we buy the components, and we got to push it through production quick. And if there's some issues to rework, whatever, you know, just do everything quick and ship it out quick, because we're not making any money. We don't want this stuff to sit in the in our workshop, make us busy for a month. We have to push it out fast. So, and of course, this doesn't lead to great quality.
No.
And then again, the customer is pissed and you know, and maybe they even give a third order. I've seen that. Because, oh yeah, they're the only ones who can make that product or whatever, you know. I mean, people just keep digging the hole, and it's never good. It's never good the third time when it's been bad the first two times. So in my experience anyway, you know, is except if the standard itself was really deficient, but if they followed they had to follow a standard and they really messed up. Two times in a row, forget it. But really, in most cases, I tell people, you know, bad results, bye-bye, you know.
Yeah.
Pick a new one. And then they say, well, you know, it takes time to look for another one. It takes time to onboard another one and so on. Correct. However, you know, don't fall into that vicious circle. I think that's the key.
And I suppose it gives you the chance to get the vetting process right, which perhaps looking back at your first supplier, you may find some areas where you perhaps didn't follow all of the best practices to vet them. And
that's right.
Ended up with a supplier that's not good enough. So at least you can approach it in the right way this time. So yeah, okay, that's good. Now, a little bit earlier on, you mentioned unexpected price rises. So just briefly, if you do face unexpected price rises from your supplier, what would you do to overcome or avoid this situation?
Well, some buyers are quite professional. And they know what drives the costs. They know that they follow up on the prices of the components or the raw materials, or you know, and some of them even know how many seconds or minutes it takes to assemble and things like that. And then they can really push back and say, well, based on my data, this, you know, this 20% raise in price really doesn't make any sense. And then it's left to the supplier to defend themselves and say, well, no, it's really okay, we can do 10% or whatever. So it kind of gets into a negotiation game. If you have no idea about the drivers of the costs and how they move and so on, well, that's going to be quite difficult. That's going to go down to a negotiation of take it or leave it, you know, that's the best I can do. Hey, if you don't want my business, I'll go somewhere else, you know. And of course, if you have a backup supplier, it's much more credible. You get caught into these kinds of arguments, and you can say, well, this, you know, this is not going to work, and you actually mean it. It's a much more comfortable situation. Then you already start to prep up the backup supplier to, you know, hey, you ready? Maybe we'll give you an order, right? Now, if both of them play the game on you, that's not good, of course. But you're in much, much better shape in that case.
Right. Okay. And keeping on the same theme of data, and I guess doing your homework as the buyer, if we look at the quality coming out of a supplier as well, how is it possible to adapt our QC strategy, which is based on your supplier's reliability and the sort of quality that they've been putting out over time?
It would depend on a lot of things, starting with the kind of requirements for consistency that the buyer side has. Maybe they actually can tolerate a lot of little issues. Maybe they really cannot tolerate anything. I mean, that's the first thing. And how good does that factory seem to be? How consistent do they seem to be? Do they have a lot of solid quality systems in place? Or does it seem like, you know, if they're on a bad day, anything could happen? So if that's the case, if it's maybe a small factory and they don't have much of any kind of structure in place and things are just managed day to day, obviously you need to give them a lot of feedback, make sure they really understand what you need. You need to do more inspections, including earlier in production, just to catch any issues that might come up. Basically, you can expect anything to happen. The risks are much higher. Now, if you work with a large manufacturer that is very well structured, no issues, you know, can be forecast, well, maybe you start with some final inspections, keep it down to one day and see where it goes. If it's perfect, then you start just skipping some batches. You don't do it on every batch. And then after a while, you know, especially with the kind of payment terms that you can negotiate, if you can negotiate payment terms after you receive the goods in your country, well, Does it make sense to keep doing a lot of inspections if their quality seems to be quite consistent? Probably not.
I suppose that over time you would review suppliers who have not performed so well, and if they start performing better in terms of quality, then you can, I don't know if relax is the right word, but perhaps modify the amount of inspections that you're actually going to perform on them.
Yes, you need to keep track of some basic statistics, about their performance in terms of quality. Maybe the pass rate on inspections is an easy one. Maybe average defect rate and things like that. On time shipments is usually an important one. Serious issues that are found maybe after shipment, the speed and the ability to follow up on corrective action plans and close these corrective actions. I mean, there's a lot of things you can track. But yes, it does make sense to adjust type of monitoring. Yes, and the same goes for laboratory testing. If they seem to be quite trustworthy, you might relax things a little bit. You might not test as much as with a company that might be ready to cheat on a component or something just to make a little bit of an extra buck.
Yeah, good. That's a good point as well, the lab testing. Okay, well, those are some really, really good points that once you're working with your supplier, I think that buyers can focus on to continue to get good results over some time. So thanks for catching up and sharing those today. That's really, really helpful.
Great. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.